So indeed, thank you very much. So I will be telling you about some explorations, some recent developments in trying to tame quantum field theory and string theory in what is perhaps its most challenging regime, the one that we commonly refer to as the finite coupling domain. So let me start with some very basic and uncontroversial stuff. So of course, I think no one would question that gauge theories are really at the very center of our understanding of nature. So it's really hard to overstate, to oversell the importance of gauge theory. You can basically write whatever you want and put as many exclamation marks as you are pleased. So indeed, so gauge theories, they describe three of the four known forces of nature. They describe electromagnetism, they describe the strong force. They are really at the very center of our description of microscopic particles. As if it was not enough, gauge theories, through the celebrated gauge gravity dualities, or holography, or ABS-CFT, provide what is perhaps the most complete non-perturbative definition of a theory of quantum gravity, which is a theory defined inside some crystal ball, which is our d-dimensional space where we have our gauge theory, represented in this cartoon by the boundary of this ball. And we have some gauge theory in d-dimensions at the boundary of this crystal ball that provides an unperturbative definition of a theory of quantum gravity inside this crystal ball in one higher dimension. So it is really, as I said, hard to overstate the importance of gauge theories in our understanding of physics, yet we are, in a way, not good enough for them. In a sense, we do not really know, despite our infinite love for gauge theory, we do not really know how a gauge theory looks like at finite coupling. We really do not, our tools are really manifestly insufficient for dealing with field theories at finite coupling. How does it look like? How do different quantities in a quantum field theory talk to each other? What are the connections between different observables in quantum field theory at finite coupling? How is it all organized in a consistent quantum field theory? What is the dynamical mechanism by which gluons become strings, by which this holographic picture arises, and by which our degrees of freedom in the gauge theory become replaced by strings in one higher dimension? So these are the sort of very vague questions that we would definitely like to understand about quantum field theory. So let me start, however, with something very, very basic, and before describing even the outline of this talk, by what we do know very well about quantum field theory and about gauge theories in particular. Of course, we all know very well how to deal with weakly coupled theories. So if we have a weakly coupled theory, what happens? We have our quark and antiquark, and they throw a gluon at each other. And then they throw two gluons. And then they throw two gluons that themselves throw a gluon, and so on and so forth. And in quantum mechanics, we sum over all possible histories of our quark and antiquark. And these cartoons, these diagrams, are nothing but what people call Feynman diagrams. And summing over all these Feynman diagrams is what people call string perturbation theory. So this is how weakly coupled particles interact, very much like Anna and Elsa in this cartoon. They go straight along this sound, and then Elsa throws a snowball at Anna, and they deflect, and this is how they interact. At strong coupling, sometimes life is also simple at strong coupling. Life is simple at strong coupling when this holographic theory is kicking, and where we get a description, not in terms of gluons, not in terms of this picture of weakly coupled theory where we just throw a snowball and then two snowballs and so on, but rather as a description, a geometrical description in terms of finding minimal areas, finding string world sheets in this higher dimensional space-time. Yes? If it is relevant that we have information about the gauge theory from lattice, oh no, that is. No, of course we do know a lot about the strongly coupled gauge theories. Yes, definitely. We have lattice. It's not like lattice can answer all of our questions. Many questions lattice cannot address. But definitely, of course, we know the mass of blue balls from lattice computation. Definitely at the same time. So now we have these two beautiful worlds where we have these beautiful analytic descriptions of weak coupling and of perturbation theory, where over the recent years we have had a boom of recent developments and with so many beautiful structures being unveiled. And when we have this strong coupling description, often in terms of strings and of minimal surfaces and this very nice geometrical problem, and then of finding these string solutions and then quantizing around these string solutions. And the question we want to understand is really what lies in between. How should we really think about what happens, not at weak coupling where gluons kick in, not at strong coupling where we have a beautiful description in terms of strings. How do we make sense of whatever lies in between? How do gluons become strings? How can we really make sense of this object? How are we supposed to think about this at finite coupling? We're not going to think in terms of gluons in 4.3 dimensions or strings in 4.7 dimensions. How are we going to think about quantum field theory at finite coupling and about how these two worlds merge together in a fully consistent picture? So this is, if you want, the grandiose motivation, but now we'll go to something much more down to earth and concrete. So here is the outline of the talk. What we are going to do first is, I will just remind what is known to everyone in the first 2 points, that gauge theories can be thought of as string theories. And then I will introduce a very special gauge theory, which is now our prototype, our guinea pig for our exploration at finite coupling, called N equals 4 super young Niels, or the Darth Vader theory, as it was recently coined by Nema. And after doing so, using this gauge theory as our laboratory, we will go on to do this exploration at finite coupling, first starting from the very simple thing you can ask about the quantum mechanical system, namely what's its spectrum, like you ask for the hydrogen atom, what's its spectrum. So that will be question number one, the very simple thing you could ask. And then we will go on to more interesting stuff, like what happens when we bash particles into each other, which is, of course, something much more interesting and dynamic. So again, let's start just by reviewing this very known fact, just to set the notation, that when you have a gauge theory, and when you are studying the interaction of an unabelian gauge theory, and you are studying the dynamics of all these gluons and so on, that you are basically describing a string theory. And this goes, if you want, back to Toth, or the argument is very simple. It is just a statement that if you consider all possible interactions of between our quark antiquark of all these gluons, you are summing over all possible histories of the quark antiquark exchanging these gluons, and these histories can be grouped together into different infinite groups of Feynman diagrams, if you want. The first three, for example, they have the property that they can be drawn on a plane. They are what people call planar Feynman diagrams. The next one, where the gluon goes below the other gluon, you need a donut to be able to draw it. And then there are some where you need a donut with two holes to be able to draw them, and so on and so forth. So your diagrams are naturally decomposed into topologies. These ones are a sphere, this one is a donut, and so on and so forth. And for a given topology, you sum over infinitely many Feynman diagrams. And this gives you these functions, non-trivial functions, of the so-called toothed coupling, which is this combination here. So what do we have when we are dealing with non-abelian gauge theory? We have a sum over topologies with some weights, in this case, one over the number of colors squared. And then for a fixed topology, we sum over all possible triangulations of our surface, over all possible Feynman diagrams. But what is this? This is what you, if you open a textbook on string theory, this is, if you want, the definition of a string theory. You sum over the topologies of your strings, and then you integrate over all possible shapes of the string, which would be summing over all these lambda factors. Okay? So again, in another cartoon, which is just repeating the same thing, here we have our quark and antiquark. Here is all the Feynman diagrams exchanging all these gluons between the quark and antiquark. And you can think of this set of Feynman diagrams as some world sheet, as some surface that is stretched between the quark and antiquark. And you can think that by summing over all Feynman diagrams, you are integrating over all possible shapes of this surface that is a quantum mechanical object. So how do we think about this surface that is stretched between the quark and antiquark? So you have this surface between the quark and antiquark. If you cut it at some finite time, this blue surface triangulated here, if you cut it at some finite time, it's a string that goes between the quark and antiquark. So the way to think of it is that we have a dual description in terms of strings. The string is nothing but the string that you get if you cut this object at some finite time. It's drawn here in blue. Okay? And this is the basic idea. And another way of thinking in terms of this string, what's another way of physically thinking in terms of this string between a quark and antiquark? purely in terms of gauge theory quantities, this string is nothing but the flux field between the quark and antiquark. It's really, you have a quark and antiquark, and there is a flux field between them. And the modern way of thinking about this solves any kind of paradoxes that you might have, because as soon as I say these words, that there is a flux between quark and antiquark, you could immediately have objected and said, wait, but if the theory is not confining, why is the flux tube a tube? I mean, it's rather something like what I have drawn here, some Faraday lines that are delocalized and that look more like the picture here in red. So who is wrong? Who is right? I mean, I'm saying before that we have here a sum over strings, but then I'm saying that the flux tube is not confined. And there is no paradox. It is just that by looking at this cartoon, which tells you that you can think in terms of strings, no one told you, just by the cartoon, where the string lives. No, you have no right to assume that the string lives in the same four-dimensional space as your quark and antiquark. And indeed, the modern way of thinking about it is that both are right. It is true that you get a string. You get a string here. But the string lives in a space with one extra holographic direction, the inside of our crystal ball. And it is the shadow of this string into our four-dimensional world that gives rise to this picture of the flux field that is delocalized in our four-dimensional shadow of this holographic direction. Okay? So again, I don't want to infer by saying that we have a string between a quark and antiquark, I don't want you to think that I'm discussing strong coupling or anything like this. I'm not saying that the string is just some classical string between the quark and antiquark. We are really doing the full quantum theory. That is, here we have to sum over all Feynman diagrams, and in this picture here, we have to sum over all possible configurations of the string between the quark and antiquark, which is a quantum mechanical problem. Okay? And that again, if n is large, this will be a string without holes, and the string tension is square root of lambda, where lambda is the coupling in the gauge theory. So you see very well, if the coupling is very small, you have a string with a very small tension, right? If the string has a very small tension, nothing suppresses its quantum fluctuations. So okay, you say, I have a description in terms of strings, but it's practically useless because the string fluctuates like crazy. It's a very, very quantum string. And then my description in terms of strings will be very complicated. And that makes sense because we know that at weak coupling, our good description is in terms of throwing this snowball. It's in terms of weak coupling, in terms of weak coupling. We are not going to have a string description. It is when you increase this coupling, when you turn on this coupling, where you would have this, in this picture of gluons, you would start throwing two snowballs, three snowballs, millions of gluons at each other, where our perturbative description will be totally useless, it is then that the string description is most useful and simplest. Because then the string tension is very strong. So if the string tension is very large, the string doesn't want to oscillate quantum mechanically and wants to just go to the minimal solution, whatever the classical string solution is. And this is where these minimal bubbles appear, and this is why I told you in the beginning that we have in these gauge theories that the theory simplifies at both endpoints. In one endpoint where we have our perturbative description in terms of one snowball, two snowballs, and so on. And that strong coupling where the string tension becomes large, and we have a description, again, geometrical, now in terms of minimal surface. Good. So what is the basic take-home message at this point? The basic take-home message is that if we are powerful enough, what we should try to do is to make all these cartoons quantitative and make them useful, not just some pictures. So what we expect to be able to do, based on everything I said so far, is to trade the four-dimensional dynamics. Trade, instead of thinking in terms of four-dimensional processes, of where the gluons are going and so on in four dimensions, we should be able to trade it by summing over, by dealing with these two-dimensional models, which are these two-dimensional strings. Now, if we can make sense of this precisely, you understand that this is a huge trade-off. Because, of course, to study a physical system in two dimensions or in four dimensions, there's no comparison. Of course, two-dimensional systems are much simpler than four-dimensional systems. So if we manage to trade our four-dimensional description by some dual hidden description in terms of a two-dimensional system, which is the two-dimensional worldsheet of this string, or the two-dimensional worldsheet of this flux tube, or the two-dimensional toothed worldsheet, whatever name you want to give it, we will be really in great shape. But now let's carry this logic further and be even greedier. And let's say, okay, so let's imagine we could have this gauge theory. Wouldn't it be awesome if we could have this gauge theory that would be four-dimensional, that would have a two-dimensional description? That would be great. But in two dimensions, we can often ask for more. We can ask for integrability. Integrability is a property of two-dimensional systems, which often is synonym of exact solvability. So integrability would mean that we would have a world sheet, we would have our string world sheet, and you sum over this quantum world sheet. And this world sheet, which is like some piece of fabric, can have ripples in it. These are the excitations, the particles that propagate on this plane. And these particles can scatter with each other quantum mechanically. And integrability would be the statement that as quantum mechanical objects, these ripples of your world sheet would scatter in a factorized way. Okay? So I'm just reviewing here. I'm not going to go through. You heard me saying this kind of thing several times. So this is what we could ask. Because if such theory existed, it would be really probably the best theory to start our explorations of quantum field theory at finite coupling. Because it would be a theory in four dimensions that would have this two-dimensional dual description. The two-dimensional dual description will be integrable, therefore much more amenable to analytic treatment. And then this integrability will therefore be inherited by the four-dimensional description. And the good news, of course, otherwise I wouldn't be giving this huge introduction, is that such theory exists. This theory is what is called n equals 4 super Young-Mills. It's a theory. It's a very symmetric cousin, if you want, of QCD, which contains gluons, but also some scalars and some fermions. And by now, there is overwhelming evidence that indeed this theory is an integrable theory in this precise sense that I just described. And people do believe that this is the theory to start with, that this is a very beautiful and very symmetric theory, very powerful one. And there is a huge consensus in the community that if we are to solve a four-dimensional gauge theory at finite coupling, this is probably the one to start. So perhaps impressed by this power, Nima recently dubbed this theory as the Darth Vader theory, and somehow recently. So I like to think of this theory as somehow the Ising model of quantum field theories, in the same way that the Ising model played a huge role in our understanding of 2D statistical models and gave rise to a burst of development and created many fields that didn't exist before. My hope is that n equals 4 will play a similar role in the space of quantum field theories as the prototype of the theory that we need to nail down first. But I'll comment more on this at the very end. So as I said, let me just make things concrete. There's nothing fancy in what I said before about integrability. You do find integrability not just by hand waving, but really looking at how this theory looks like and asking yourself, do the excitations in this theory scatter in a factorized way or not? If I take three excitations in my theory and scatter them with each other, does it become a sequence of two-body scattering events or not? Is the theory integrable or not? And this you can do. For example, at strong coupling, these bumps, what are these excitations? They are just bumps of your string. You just put your string, put some bumps, like some soliton in your violin string, throw these bumps at each other, throw these three bumps at each other, and ask yourself, is it integrable or not? Actually, what people did was a bit different. They found some existence of some hidden symmetry, some higher charges that will in turn imply this, but it's equivalent. And indeed, beautifully, you find that indeed, the string sigma model has the extra symmetry required for this integrability to hold at strong coupling. And then you go and ask, what is the counterpart of this picture at weak coupling in the gauge theory? A string is dual to an operator, a composite operator, that is made out of many fields in your theory, and the fields can be represented as sites of a quantum spin chain. And it so turns out that the dynamics of these composite operators, the way the operators mix with each other in perturbation theory, can be precisely mapped to the dynamics of an integrable spin chain, as understood by Minahan and Zarembo. So out of the many spin chains that we could get, out of the many interactions that we could get in our string theory, it seems as we land on exactly on the ones that have this integrable world in the beginning. And then people did many checks, both at weak and at strong coupling, and this is, if you want, our working hypothesis that the theory is quantum integrable. And then you can turn on the wheel, and let's go then to the study of the simplest possible quantity in a quantum field theory, in the quantum field theory, its spectrum. So what is the spectrum of the theory? The spectrum of the theory, well, you have this string. It's the energies of all possible strings. You want to find what is the energy of all possible strings inside this crystal ball. Or what is the energy of all possible spin chain states in terms of composite operators in the theory. And there was a long story starting in 2002. I don't want to go into too many details, where people started understanding the spin chains, starting understanding classical strings. Then it was understood that really the key object that merges both together is this S matrix, this scattering of fundamental excitations. It should be clear from my discussion as well. With knowing how particles scatter, you can put particles in some very large string or in some very large spin chain because they have enough space to scatter. And just by understanding how they scatter, you can quantize them using the so-called Bittensatz, which basically tells you that if you take a particle around your very big circle, it scatters with everyone else until it comes back to the original position. And imposing this periodicity condition, you quantize your system. Of course, strictly speaking, this is wrong because your system is big, but it's finite, so you need to take into account finite set corrections that people did. And then you have to do some fancy analytic continuation tricks and some weak rotations to really tame finite volume, not only finite corrections. And this leads to the so-called Y system or thermodynamic Bittensatz, which are a set of functional equations that describe the spectrum of planar n equals 4 super Young Mills. And with these equations, you can finally take, say, your simplest possible operator in your theory and ask for what is its energy, what is its dimension. That operator goes by the name of Konishi, and here is the plot of Konishi dimension at any value of the toothed coupling. All the way from the gluons to the strings, here is how the plot of the energy of this state looks like. And this, I mean, it looks kind of a boring monotonic plot, but it was really super exciting to do. So let me discuss it a little bit. So you start when lambda is equal to 0 and the energy is 4. 4, it makes total sense. If I would write to you what this operator looks like, you would see that the canonical dimension, the engineering dimension, the classical dimension of the field is 4 because it's made of 4 fields. So if you turn off the coupling and go to the free theory, it should start with 4, and it does. Then it has some slope here. And this slope is something that, in principle, we could take our integrability predictions and compare this slope and its derivatives with perturbation theory. And this, by now, has been done to 5 loops in perturbation theory, which is hundreds of thousands of Feynman diagrams, and beautifully agrees with the way this curve deviates from 4. But then what's exciting is that you don't need to stay in perturbation theory. You can now go, get out of the radius of convergence and go all the way to this 2 times lambda to the 1/4 asymptotical, which was exactly what people knew ought to happen if this operator were to become a small string moving in the middle of this crystal ball. And this number, this 2, is not at all put by hand. For us, it's kind of a miracle. In fact, we don't know how to derive these numbers analytically. It's just an outcome of solving these equations numerically. And the fact that we start with gluons and go all the way and find exactly the behavior that you expect right on that Gapser, Klebanov, and Polyakov had predicted for these small strings in EDS is really very encouraging. So here is the realization of this idea that you start with gluons, you turn on, and you end up with strings with some classical energy that you could have predicted from other arguments, and then some semi-classical correction that we predicted in this work and that 2 years later was confirmed by a direct perturbative computation. So there are 2 messages that I want to take home. One is that we have the result for the spectrum. Okay, one is the result itself. After a huge effort of many, many people, finally, we have the spectrum of a 4-dimensional gauge theory at any value of the coupling. So this is kind of important, and in fact, it's not only important just because we can put it in a nice review, it's important because the spectrum is often something useful, and when we will construct more interesting quantities, one of the ingredients that we are going to use is the spectrum that we saw before. So this is one of the things, one of the reasons, of course, why it is very important. But it is also important, I find, psychologically, because it really overcomes the psychological barrier. I mean, in principle, now we know we can put the bar higher. It is possible to tame a gauge theory at finite coupling. We had all these cartoons, all this hand-waving, and so on, and often the hand-waving stops at the hand-waving. It's important to know, can it really be done? And it seems that, yes, indeed, there are some obstacles to overcome, but we can indeed tame gauge theories at finite coupling. But then, immediately, you are more ambitious and say, okay, the spectrum is the spectrum, it's interesting, but even more interesting is to go and study more dynamical observables, like what happens when I bash particles against each other, when I compute correlation function, when I study Wilson loops, and so on and so forth. And here there are 2 points of view you can take. One point of view is if you want the optimistic point of view, saying that all these cartoons, they look more or less the same. You just have some worldsheet, some toothed worldsheet, but you are tailoring it into different topologies. So you have some material, and if you can make a t-shirt out of it, you can make whatever you want. You just tailor it in different ways. So if really the underlying reason for this success is this material being very special and the ripples in this material behaving in this very special factorized way, perhaps we just take the same fabric, tailor it in different ways, and we solve these other quantities. So this would be the optimistic point of view. The more cautious point of view would be to say yes. However, we should also keep in mind that the spectrum is the spectrum. And with some insight, the spectrum, it could have been solved faster. It was, if you want, in the book. I mean, what I mean is that if you would ask someone, some hardcore integrabilist, and if you would tell them, I have an integrable model. I want to compute its spectrum at finite volume. He will give you a recipe. He will say, OK, first understand one particle, then understand two particles. Once you understand one and two particles, putting many particles together is more or less straightforward because of factorization. Now put them at finite volume. Find the asymptotic spectrum at large volume using Bittan's odds. Then study finite size correction, weak rotate, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, it's not as simple as I'm oversimplifying things because this is not a random integrable model. I think this is really the integrable model, the richest of integrable models. If you think of an integrable model, what do you think typically? A quantum spin chain, Heisenberg spin chain, and so on. Or a relativistic sigma model, like the ON sigma model and other relativistic sigma models. And this model is neither. It is not a spin chain, it is not a sigma model, it's both. It's a model that at strong coupling becomes an unrelativistic, a relativistic sigma model. At weak coupling, it becomes a spin chain. It's not relativistic, its symmetry is much bigger than any symmetries of other models we consider. And in fact, inside it, as subsectors, all these models, Heisenberg spin chain, Hubbard model, ON sigma models, all these models are contained as particular subsectors of this huge integrable model. So yes, it would not have been totally trivial. However, it was true that within sight, it is perhaps not surprising that we were able to solve it, because indeed, there is more or less a procedure for solving this theory. So now, for attacking these more exciting quantities, you can be either excited that it not that now, for what we are doing next, there's no book. You can really try not to do the same mistake, be sure to ask all the integrability experts, can I now tailor my integrable theory and put it in different topologies, and nothing is known. So we have no book to follow, but of course this is exciting, because it means we will have to develop truly new techniques, both in gauge theories and in integrable models, if we want to study more interesting quantities, such as what happens when we bash particles into each other, like when we have a scattering amplitude. Like when we take some beams, we scatter them and receive many particles as the outgoing state. Or if we want to study our interactions between quarks and antiquarks in, by describing so-called Wilson loops. So let's go on to the study of these two quantities. And the reason why I put them together in the same title is because in any close force, super young Niels, these two very important observables in gauge theory are actually connected to each other, as I'm now going to explain. So let me first review some very basic things. So what is a Wilson loop? A Wilson loop is the response of the chromodynamic gauge field to a classical particle moving along a loop in space-time. And this loop is what gives the name to Wilson loop. So you take your classical particle, like your quark, that goes along some loop in space-time. It will be clear why I chose a loop with cuts. And you study the interaction of this particle with one gluon, two gluons, many gluons. And then the picture, of course, is that these gluons, they are nothing but forming this string or this flux between this quark and quark. And this is what a Wilson loop is. Okay? And of course, this is a very important observable in gauge theory. Take, for example, a rectangular Wilson loop. Take a quark that goes along a big rectangle. The top and bottom are irrelevant. And now study the dependence of this Wilson loop as you increase or decrease the width of this rectangle. What is this rectangle? You have a quark going to the future and coming back to the past. So it's a quark going to the future and an anti-quark going to the future as well. And by studying the dependence on the width of this rectangle, you are studying the potential between the quark and anti-quark and figuring out whether the theory is confining or not confining. Of course, it's a very important non-local probe in your gauge theories. Definitely very important. Scattering amplitude is, of course, a quantity that doesn't need an introduction. It is just gives you the probability amplitude for bashing some on-shell particles with momentum k1, k2, and so on. All these particles are null vectors. We are scattering gluons and getting some other particles as external states. And in n equals 4 super young Niels, Wilson loops that were already very important are even more important because there exists a remarkable duality that, if you want, I can tell you more about. It's really a beautiful story. Between these amplitudes, these crucial observables, the textbook example number one of what we learned in quantum field theory, and these Wilson loop objects. Namely, if you take a scattering amplitude, you can construct a loop in the following way. Take your vectors of the scattering particles and take k1, then put k2 after k1, and so on. You concatenate all vectors one after the other, k1, k2, k3, k4, k5, k6, k7, and so on. This will lead to a closed polygon. It will be closed because of momentum conservation, because the sum of all momenta in a scattering amplitude is zero. And it is what is called a null polygon. It is null because all edges are null vectors, because, again, I'm scattering gluons. Okay, so this is the basic, the slide of introduction to this one. What is our goal? Our goal is to compute scattering amplitude at any value of the coupling in a four-dimensional gauge field. And here is the basic philosophy, the basic ideas that we are going to follow. So first, in this theory, we can think of the scattering amplitudes either in the with the cartoon at the bottom of the previous slide or in terms of the Wilson loop. And because the Wilson loop comes automatically with this nice picture that I've been describing of the flux between the quark and antiquark, which is dual to the string, and we know a lot about the spectrum of these strings and so on, let's stick to the flux tube picture. So what our goal is to transform cartoons like the ones in this picture into precise equations that gives us the scattering amplitude at any value of the cup. So what does this cartoon mean? This cartoon means that, in principle, I should be able to describe this Wilson loop by summing over all possible states of my flux to between the quark and antiquark. Right? This is clear. I'm just cutting my path integral, if you want, at this fixed time here, and of course I should sum over everything that can flow between this quark and antiquark. This is cartoon number one. Cartoon number two means that I should be able to do this open string partition function for any value of the string tension, that is, for any quantum string that is oscillating and that ends on this polygon. Okay? So this is the problem we are set to solve. And what are the basic ideas that we are going to use? And if you want to take some idea home, this is the basic strategy. One is, we have this flux between this quark and antiquark, and the flux is evolving with the quark and antiquark. And the point is that we know how to evolve the flux. Because to evolve a quantum system, this is what we know how to do if we know the spectrum of the theory. But we know the spectrum of strings This was the first part of the talk. So the idea is to use the knowledge of the spectrum to know how to detain this flux tube and how to evolve this flux tube stretch between this quark and antiquark. This is idea number one. But this problem is more complicated. It's not just the quark and antiquark evolving boringly from the minus infinity to plus infinity. There is geometry. It's rather a polygon that is full of cusps and so on. So what we have to do is we evolve our flux tube, but then there is a cusp, and the flux tube is kicked, and then it evolves again, and then there is a cusp, and the flux tube is kicked, and it evolves again, and then another cusp, and so on and so forth. So what we have to do is to evolve by patches. So what we will have to do is patch our Wilson loop, patch our toothed worldsheet, into pieces, into squares, where we do tame its evolution. And then, like a quilt, we patch it like exactly like a Canadian quilt, like here. And the objects we will use to patch are exactly like in this picture, pentagons, that we will use to govern the transitions between the regions where we do know how to evolve. So again, the idea is try to come up with a tessellation that allows us to tame the geometry and use the knowledge of the spectrum to evolve our flux tube. And if we can make this precise, we can propose a solution for scattering amplitudes at finite coupling in a gauge tube. Any questions here on the basic logic? Sorry. Very good. So let's explain why pentagon. So here is the basic idea now in some more detail. The basic idea is that if you have a null polygon, here is a polygon with eight edges. If you want to count it as eight edges. And the basic idea is that there is a canonical way of tessellating null polygons as a sequence of null squares. Here is one square where the vacuum is. Here is another square where psi 1 is. Here is another square where psi 2 is, a square where psi 3 is, and a square where the vacuum is. Okay? So first, there is a canonical way of breaking a polygon down into a sequence of null squares. And this is where the state will propagate. It will start in the vacuum, get kicked, go to psi 1, get kicked, go to psi 2, get kicked, go to psi 3, and then go back to the vacuum. And then to answer this question, you see what happens. Take any two squares and consider the union of any two consecutive squares. What's the union of two squares? It's a pentagon object. So the pentagon object, this P that appears here between 0 and psi 1, describes what's the probability of starting with a vacuum and going to psi 1. This one describes what's the probability of starting with psi 1 and going to psi 2, and so on and so forth. So this P here, it's called the pentagon, and it's the object that describes these transitions, as I said. And then, whenever you are in a given square, you know how to evolve it. And you evolve it with some energy times time, momentum times space, and angular momentum times an angle. Okay? Where the precise explanation of these variables is written here in this slide. The basic geometrical idea is that a square, a null square, naturally has three symmetries, one of them being a time, a space, and an angle. So we know how to govern the transition in each square. We know that there is some time, and multiplying this time, there will be some energy. Some space, and multiplying the space, there will be the momentum of the corresponding flux loop state. And some angle, so multiplying this angle, will be the angular momentum. So this is the basic idea. You coordinatize all your null polygons using this tessellation in the very much the same way that you would coordinatize all in equivalent configuration of this carnival snake. You would take this snake, and how would you parameterize all possible snakes? You would look at the given middle square of this snake and act with the symmetries of this middle square on the bottom tail of the snake. For example, you would move the tail of the snake left and right. Of course, if you move the full snake, you are doing nothing. That's the definition of a symmetry. And this is exactly what you do. So you, to measure what flows along some square, you take the symmetries of the square and act to the bottom of the square. And then you have the propagation on each of the squares and these pentagons governing the transition. And this probably sounds familiar, and it should sound familiar, because this is nothing but the exact counterpart of the usual operator product expansion that we have in conformal field theories for describing correlation functions of operators in a conformal field theory. So here is what is familiar, I'm sure, to everyone. When we take a correlation function of operators in a CFT, we can take two operators, fuse them, and we have a structure constant here, and sum over what flows, then sum over what flows, then sum over what flows. And this sum over psi 1, psi 2, psi 3 are the analog of summing over the state psi 1, psi 2, psi 3. Exactly the analog. And these objects that govern the transitions, the structure constants, blue, red, are exactly the analog of the four pentagons in this picture. So we really have an analog construction in the same way that we can describe any CFT in terms of structure constants and the spectrum. This is nothing but what we have done here. We decomposed our Wilson loop in terms of the very analogous quantities. The spectrum that enters here, and it's the only place where the geometry enters, and the pentagon that is the analog of the structure constant that governs the transitions along our polygon. And like with the conformal field theory, yes. Very good. it is true, and there is even more to be said. So in this theory, there are two quark-antiquark potentials that you could be interested in. A quark-antiquark potential between quarks that are static, or if they are moving, you can always go to a reference frame where they are static, so it doesn't matter. Or the quark-antiquark potential between two quarks that are both moving at the speed of light, and that's not related by symmetry to the other one, right? And you can compute both. And in this example, if the lines would be infinite, it would be the second one, because these lines are null. So this would be a quark-antiquark both moving at the speed of light with a flux cube between them. But you could also do static quark-antiquark. It was done by Sever, Maldacena, and Correa. This is an equal force frame. Okay, so, and in the same way as in a CFT, the operator product expansion is valid for any conformal field theory. Okay. The potential decays like 1 over r. It's Coulomb potential, and what is interesting is computing the charge, the renormalization of the charge. So it is alpha of lambda over r, and you are interested in alpha of lambda. So, yeah. Sorry? No, the coupling constant doesn't run. It's a CFT. The flux tube states? Yeah, I will describe what the states are in the next slide. Any other question? Okay, so in the same way that in a CFT, this picture is valid for any CFT, indeed, everything that I have said here is valid in any conformal gauge theory. It has nothing to do with planarity, with n equals 4, with supersymmetry, with integrability, with n. Integrability comes next when we start to try to make sense and to really deal and tame this expression, which otherwise still looks a little bit formal. And this is, and taming this expression is what we can beautifully do in this theory, and this is what makes it, I think, so powerful. So as I said, the basic idea is that we know what these strings are. We know how to describe this flux tube between the quark and antiquark. This flux tube is just an open string, so it's a stretched string, and you can stretch a string by taking basically a local operator and put and considering large spin limit of a local operator with many, 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 many derivatives that basically stretch the local operator into an open string. Or equivalently, this is nothing but considering a null Wilson line with some insertions of these fields along the null Wilson line. Or this is also equivalent to taking your folded GKP folded string, this folded string dual to this flux tube, and putting two bumps of energy. So there are three descriptions. They are totally equivalent. You can use whichever one you like the most. Let's focus on this spin chain one here. So this, thinking about this sum over flux tube states is synonym to thinking in terms of this local operator with very large spin and some insertions on top of it. So this is something familiar. What we are doing is we start with some simple state. Then we put some derivatives that are some excitations. And we put more and more and more. We put millions of them and go to a very non-trivial excited state. And then we study the effective excitation on top of this excited state. So let me give you an example where we do this, which is much more familiar. Suppose you want to study a one-dimensional magnetic system, a magnetic spin chain. And you want to study it in the anti-ferromagnetic regime, which is the hard regime. And what you can do is you can start by the ferromagnetic state, where all spins are up, and then put one magnet, which is one spin down, and then two magnets, two spins down, and then three spins down, until you put many, many spins down, until you put half of the spins, you flip them. This means that you are putting many, many, many magnets going to a very excited state, and then you study the effective excitations on the antiferromagnetic vacuum, which in condensed matter are called spinons. So this is how you could describe the spinon excitations around the antiferromagnetic, by starting with a ferromagnetic, putting many, many, many excitations, getting some integral equation, because you would have now millions of excitations, and then integrating this, inverting this kind of integral equations to get the dynamics around this non-trivial vacuum. And this is exactly what we do here. We start with some trivial vacuum. We put these many, many derivatives, which basically, physically, we think of as stretching this operator. And once it is stretched, we put some two-gauge fields there that move along this flux. So here is the full mathematical notebook, for example, to describe quantities around this flux. For example, imagine you want to ask, take your flux tube, put a gauge field excitation, and ask what is its mass. What is the mass of an excitation? It means the energy when the momentum of the excitation is zero. That's the definition of a mass. So I want to study the mass of my gauge field as you change the coupling, all the way from weak coupling to strong coupling. And this is all there is. So you have this inverse here, and this inverse here is exactly doing this procedure. Of course, I'm not asking you to go through the details. It's exactly doing this procedure of inverting and going to this non-trivial vacuum. It's a universal operation. You always want to do it. You always want to stretch and go to this vacuum. And then once you are in this stretched vacuum, what we want to do next? Do response theory. Put stuff there and see how this vacuum reacts. Put some F excitation, put two F excitations if you want to study the S matrix, put two scalar excitations if you want to study the S matrix of two scalars, and so on. And this is what we have here. We have a universal matrix, K, that we are inverting, dotted with a vector, KG. This G stands for gluon, which is the source that you would put if you want to put a gluon on top of your flux. And here is, for example, an example all the way from weak to strong coupling. The gluon excitation starts with mass 1 and goes to mass square root of 2. So keep this square root of 2 in mind. So this means that out of the three elements in this formula, we got rid of two. We understand very well how to tame these first two. That is, summing over flux tube states is not something mysterious. It is just that you say, what is the sum over flux tube state? Well, the first state is the vacuum, just stretched flux tube without anything. First excited state, flux tube with one excitation, which moves on the flux tube with momentum p. Second excited state, flux tube with two excitations that move with momentum p1 and p2. Three excitations with p1, p2, p3, and so on and so forth. And then this excitation, they can be gluons, fermions, scalars, and you should sum over it. So this is what it means to sum over this flux tube. And then for a given state, as I said, we have total control over the spectrum of this flux field, so we can just tame this propagation part, which is where the geometry ends. Now, what we understood more recently with Benjamin and Amit was how to tame this other, which is really the most important building block, which is the pentagon, which actually is actually, I find, the most interesting part. So this is what I want to discuss next. I want to tell you a little bit, how should we think about this pentagon object? So this pentagon is a transition between a state. For example, imagine you have an heptagon here, you have a pentagon here in the middle, and you have a transition between psi 1 going to psi 2. So these states can have many particles, but as we said before, in integrable theory, it is often the case that if you control the state with a few number of particles, then you can get a state with many particles. So with this motivation in mind, let's study the simplest possible thing. In the bottom of your pentagon, you put one single excitation with momentum parameterized by some variable that we call the rapidity u. U you can think of as the momentum. And at the top, we put one excitation. So this could be a transition between here, can you see the pointer? Having a state here with one gluon and here a state with one gluon. And how do we go about computing this missing block at any coupling? And the idea is not to do perturbation theory and not to do string theory. That is just too hard. We don't want to do any kind of traditional approach. What we want to do is bootstrap the approach based on its analytic properties and on the power of analyticity and just imposing physical requirements. So this is what you often do in what sometimes you can do in integrable models. You can really bootstrap. The picture of bootstrap is picking yourself from your bootstraps. So it's really trying to, without doing anything, somehow getting to the full result. And this is what we do. You postulate a set of axioms that this object should satisfy. Some axioms are trivial, like the first one. They just tell you that the pentagon has some kind of parity. If you flip top and bottom, you should get the same pentagon. Some of them are a bit more complicated. They are related to the fact that if you swap two excitations in an integrable model, you should get the S matrix of these two excitations. What is this X matrix? Don't confuse this with the four-dimensional S matrix. This is the two-dimensional flux cube S matrix. You have your flux cube, you have two components moving here in your flux cube, and boom, they scatter with each other and they acquire some phase. This is the S matrix here. And this is an S matrix that is known at any value of the coupling. So you see already the power of the coupling coming in. We start to have axioms that are inherently non-perturbative and that require the full knowledge of objects at finite coupling, and that's what makes them very powerful. And then we have some axiom that tells you that if you use some kind of weak rotation to move particles around in this pentagon geometry, you get back to an object that still looks like a pentagon. And all these axioms, they should be valid at finite coupling, and the coupling, even though it doesn't enter here, obviously, remember that it enters because the S matrix is known at finite coupling, and it also enters, less trivially, because the transformation that implements this weak rotation that tells you how to move particles is actually also a finite coupling transformation. And this one is actually very beautiful because the way the math works is that this is an analytic continuation that in a complex plane involves doing a monodromy. And it involves doing a monodromy where you go in the complex plane and pass through a cut, a branch cut of a Riemann surface, and you pass through the cut and come back to the same position. And what is the width of this cup? Is twice the coupling. So you have no way of doing it in perturbation theory. You need to first solve it at finite coupling, go through this cut, and then you can let perturbation theory kick in, and then you can close the cut. It's like Indiana Jones. It needs to first go in, and then the door can close. If you the door closes first, it's bad news. And then you go about, and you find the solution to these equations. And of course, there are many solutions, and you have to argue why it is good. And here you find a solution, and then once you have a solution, you can indeed, as I anticipated, deal with many particles in a rather straightforward way. And here I want to look a little bit at this formula to point out something that I find truly very beautiful. Here in this formula, the left-hand side is phase time and the right-hand side is world shape. The left-hand side is the pentagon object. It's the object that is directly the building block for this four-dimensional scattering amplitude. It's the object that if you start with a scattering amplitude, you just look at the amplitude and you read off its pentagons. Like if you start with a correlation function, you analyze the correlation function and you read off the structure constant. And on the right, you have the S, this S, which is the S matrix of excitations on the flux tube, on the string. So you have here a very, very sharp connection between the space-time S matrix and the flux tube S matrix. And this, if you want, is the missing link. And as soon as we found this kind of relation, we knew that integrability ought to be very useful in solving this problem. Now, according to, I have a clock here. According to this clock, I just described all this construction in roughly 10 minutes, which is way less than what I normally do. So this is probably a bit too hard. And I want to demystify it a little bit at the expense of introducing yet more quantities whose notation might not be very clear, but at least it will be a very simple computation. Just to show you a little bit how things look like in practice and how we first found this nice axiom that you swap particles and you get TF matrix. So just to give you a flavor of how happy we were and why we knew we were on the right track, let me tell you about some nice computation. So suppose we want to check these ideas by considering the simplest possible setup. So now we go to weak coupling, we go to the weakest possible coupling, so we go to so-called three-level. Three-level is really N and Delta throwing a single glue ball at each other, a single snowball at each other, really the simplest possible process. So these three-level processes, they are known. There are a gazillion ways of computing these three-level amplitudes. The cleanest of those are Freddy's BCSW recursion relations, which are implemented in many Mathematica packages. So we can take a Mathematica package by Jake, Freddy's collaborator, and ask, how does this scattering amplitude look like? I don't want to tell you too much about the notation, but just in case you are wondering, these labels here just tell you about what ellipticity is of what particles are being scattered. And this picture here just means that this is a particular component of a scattering amplitude that is roughly described by a scalar excitation going all the way from the bottom to the top in perturbation P. Okay, just for you to have a rough idea of what this is. Now, what do we do with this data that we extract, as I said, from just taking Freddy's solution for scattering amplitudes, and this is the result. Now, this doesn't tell me much. So what I do is I plug in these coordinates that I like, these snake-like coordinates, this tau 1, tau 2, sigma 1, sigma 2. So let's look at what happens when we take these variables and take this tau 1, tau 2 to be large. This is what we get. So now let's go through this a little bit. So first, taking tau 1 and tau 2 to be large means taking your heptagon and doing this flattening procedure where you flatten the top and the bottom. So this is a way, as I said, of extracting exactly this pentagonometry. So at the end, you end up with a pentagon where with an excitation here at some position sigma 2, which is the sigma 2 here that you can move, and another excitation here at sigma 1, which you can move again by playing with sigma 1. And this is perfect in agreement with our intuition. There's already some juice that we can extract out of this. For example, the fact that the amplitude goes to zero with e to the minus tau 1 minus tau 2. This means that you have a particle with energy 1 here and a particle with energy 1 here. What is this particle? It's the scalar. Because we said that we put a scalar at the bottom. The scalar cannot annihilate, so we must have a scalar at least here and here. So that's the leading term, the scalar going from the top to the bottom. You might remember that I also had some angle variables, phi 1 and phi 2. They don't appear. Why? Because the scalar has no ellipticity. So there is no factors of e to the I phi that come together in this limit. That's why there is no phi here. That's also good. And then we have this function, very simple function of sigma 1 and sigma 2. But this is not what I want. I want a pentagon transition. So what I want is to Fourier transform to get the pentagon transition between a stated momentum P1 to a stated momentum P2. So we take this very nice expression and we do this terrible thing and we write it as a bunch of integral, double integral over some gamma function. But this is really like seeing half Santa Claus, as I'm now going to explain. Because from a totally different computation, what you could do is take your flux field, put two scalar excitations, and study how they scatter with each other. And we were, of course, very well aware of this computation. And what does this give? It gives some phase. And the phase is given by this S matrix here. And when you see, what do you see here? You see that you have three gamma functions that are exactly the pentagon, and here you have exactly the pentagon where you flip P1 and P2. And this is exactly this axiom that I said. Take your pentagon object, divide by the same thing with P1 and P2 exchange, and you should get the S matrix. So this is the simplest realization, and of course when you see something like this, it really looks like Santa Claus. Right? I mean, once you see this, and then you see this, it really looks like it wants to work. But then what you go is, still using Jake's package, you can also ask for one loop amplitude. Now one loop amplitude is more complicated stuff. And you can take your one loop amplitude, stretch again, Fourier transform again. Now doing the Fourier transform took us like 2 weeks just to do the Fourier transform. You get a complicated expression. It will fill the full slide. You divide by the same thing with P1 over P2 exchange. And miraculously, it agrees with the S matrix expanded one loop further computed from integrability. So it was at that moment, roughly 1 year ago, that when we first saw this, way before coming up with all these axioms and so on, when we saw this first hint of a connection between the space-time S-matrix and the flux-tube S-matrix, that then it was just a question of working hard till all the structure came together. So here we have a proposal for scattering amplitudes at any value of the coupling based on many conjectures of the spectrum that itself is based on conjectures of the model being integrable, then the bootstrap axioms whose solution is also a conjecture because it could imagine more solution. It's really a formalism that is very powerful. It's true at finite coupling, but because of being so based on integrability and on this cartoon kind of picture, it's very important to really put it to test. I mean, after all, we hand-waved so much, we better now confront it with some hardcore tests and see what this formalism has to say about weak, strong, and finite coupling. So in the remaining 10 minutes, this is what I want to tell you about. Okay? Is there any question before I move on to the to the explanation of how this very alien approach, you see, if I tell you that this is the scattering amplitude, it doesn't look very much like a scattering amplitude, right? It's really a formulation of a scattering amplitude, which it looks more like some kind of gas of some flux tube excitation, and I'll come back to this moment later. So it's very important, of course, to cross-check this against other approaches. And it's actually more than cross-check, because right now, this program is what is being used by people like Lance Dixon and collaborators who are doing the most hardcore loop computations in the field. So people like Lance that are now computing 6-point scattering amplitudes up to crazy numbers like 5 loops and 4 loops. I don't know if Matt is in the audience. Matt is doing there, is doing a 4-loop computation with Lance. And how are they doing this crazy high loop computations at 4 and 5 loops? I mean, throw one and else out of the window. I mean, Feynman diagrams, it's totally useless. I mean, it would be basically impossible. So how do they go about doing this perturbative computation? Well, the basic idea is that they have by now a very well understood, a very good understanding of the space of functions in terms of which the final results have to be expressed. After so much experience, they can tell you at 4 loops, you can have this kind of polylogarithm, this kind of iterated integrals. They have kind of a list of this is probably the kind of functions that will appear in the final result. And then they make a huge ansatz, A1 times function 1, A2 times function 2. They make a huge ansatz with hundreds of coefficients. You could hit a Mickey Mouse with that. Okay? And you have like hundreds of free parameters. But then how do you go about fixing all these free parameters just based on understanding the structure of the result? Well, on the other hand, we have this expression at finite coupling. We can Taylor expand, we can series expand our results, give them the first 100 terms of our series expansion, and they can use that to fix the 100 terms in their ansatz. But the most exciting part is what comes next, which is really kind of a symbiotic relation, you know, like birds on top of the rhino, and it helps both the birds and the rhino, which is that once you fix all the constants in your ansatz, once you give the first 100 terms in Taylor expansion, now you can check the next 1,000 coefficients. And without any free parameter, it better be that they agree spot on. And this is a very non-trivial check because, for example, in this example, actually, so far, only A and B were useful. All these terms in blue, all these terms here, were cross-checked without any free parameter. You see numbers like 3,217 over 8, all these crazy numbers are matched after fixing without any free parameter, and they work beautifully. So this is very good news because on the one hand, it tells Lance and Matt and collaborators that their ansatz was almost for sure correct because it's such a powerful self-consistency check that they fix many constants and then they have yet infinitely many more and it all works out. But it's also very good for us because it tells us that our conjectures are probably correct, at least up to this crazy number of loops. And then when we are very confident that probably we did not screw up too badly, given all these matches, we can go and ask now even tougher questions. What happens now with our formulation if instead of going to weak coupling, we now turn on the coupling and go to the hardest regime, to strong coupling, say? This is the regime where basically there's no other approach that could try to go to strong coupling. So let's look at a bit at what we should find. What do we expect to find? So this is not what we get from this expression that I wrote you, this is what we should find. So what should we find at strong coupling? We should get this area of these soap bubble films that end on this pole. Now, in the second or third slide, I wrote that life is simple at strong coupling. You just need to compute its minimal areas and so on. Of course, it's a big oversimplification, because even this trivial geometrical problem, for example, was well posed and well understood that this is what we have to do in 2007, and it took until 2011 till we managed to compute the area of these null polygons. And to do it, actually, you have to use some fancy artillery of classical integrability of the string sigma model. But when we did, and we expand our result, and we look at our result, the result was very inspiring. It was a little bit like the weak coupling result that I showed you before. Sometimes you look at the result, and it's really screaming at you and telling you what the physics should be. And this result was very inspiring, because you solved the purely geometrical problem. What is the area of this soap bubble film? And what result do you get? The result took the form of a quantum mechanically partitioned function, a free energy. It took the form of a sum over relativistic particles, one particle, two particles, three particles, and so on. And this was very mysterious at the time, but of course, it's obvious what it is, right? It is just the sum over the plus two particles that I was describing before that is showing up. But let's forget that we know the answer for a moment and look at how the area looks like. So here again, I have the area of this minimal surface, and I expand it in this stretching parameter tau. And what do we see there? We see three particles, two with mass square root of 2. You see there is square root of 2 cos theta, square root of 2 sin theta. And they come with helicity plus 1 and minus 1. And then we have one particle with mass 2. We see three excitations. And this is indeed what you expect, because your string is a two-dimensional surface, right? So you have a two-dimensional surface in ADS 5, which is a five-dimensional space. So there are indeed three transverse modes of the string that you can excite. So it's good that you are getting three modes. Okay, so that's perfect. And indeed, Arkady Zeitlin and Sergei Frolov, when they quantized this folded string, they did find three modes, and the modes match precisely this mass. So that's good. So this is indeed now begging to go back to our sum, finite coupling sum over the flux tube, and try to see, does this come about? Do we get these three modes with mass square root of 2 and with mass 2, these three modes coming out of the previous experiment? And the answer is yes, but we do learn something that I find very amusing, so let me tell you about it. So let's look at our flux tube, and here are all the excitations that you can put on the flux tube, fermions, scalars, gluons, and so on. And here is their mass. And you see that there is a mass, that one of them that goes from 1 to square root of 2, the gluon. This is the plot that I did to you, that I did for you a few slides before. And there is no particle, and there are two gluons, positive and negative helicity. So that's very nice, because we see that as we increase the coupling, two of the excitations of my flux tube, they start with mass 1, they go to mass square root of 2, and they will become two of the transverse modes of the string. But where is the mass 2? There is no excitation that gets a mass 2 at strong coupling. So what does it mean? Does it mean that the mass 2 doesn't appear, that something is wrong, ADS-CFT doesn't work? What does it mean? No, it does work, but it's much nicer the way it works. So let's again focus first on the two modes that are simpler. So the way it works is that these two modes that are the gluons, they go to square root of 2. Their pentagon transition becomes 1 plus something small. And then in our sum over excitations, it exponentiates the result. And in the exponent, you get all the infinite terms that you should get, all the ones that have square root of 2 in them, all the terms with mass square root of 2. And then the mass 2 is a bit tougher to get, but it does come out, and it comes out very nicely as a bound state that is only at strong coupling, only asymptotically, two fermion excitations form a bound state, and they give rise to a bosonic excitation at strong coupling. So only at strong coupling, so these fermions normally they are moving freely in the flux field, but asymptotically at strong coupling, they form this bosonic bound state of mass 2, 1 plus 1 is 2, and this fermion excitation is what gives rise to the missing string mode. And this is indeed, if you now reinterpret a little bit, this is quite cute, because we have these two modes, the square root of 2, which are the easy ones. You can think of them that they are the dual of the two transverse modes if the flux tube were in four dimensions. The flux tube was in four dimensions, there are two transverse modes. But there is another mode that should emerge only at strong coupling, because only at strong coupling you really have a classical space-time with one more dimension. So this is a transverse mode in the direction that was not there at recoupling, that was not there in the four-dimensional description. So it is exactly according to our intuition. What is happening is that at any finite coupling, the fermions are moving freely. But at strong coupling, they are merging together. They form this Cooper pair, and this extra logarithmic direction, this extra mode of the string, comes about. So this is, of course, just the beginning. There are many other things that we have been understanding that I just don't have time to tell. And there are many things that we are now starting to try to play with. Now that we have a formulation at finite coupling, it's a very exciting time where we can ask many cute questions. And but I just don't have much time now to go into these other questions. However, I do want to mention something that is probably at least equally important, which is that now we can really do finite coupling. We don't need to do weak coupling or strong coupling. It's very interesting to do weak coupling and strong coupling. It's very interesting to understand as many analytic limits as you can, high energy limit, collinear limits, everything. That we are going to do for sure. But at the same time, here is something you can do. This result here, it is begging to be put on a computer. This result here tells you that to get a scattering amplitude at any coupling, you should sum over flux tube configuration with some Boltzmann weight. So this is begging to do Monte Carlo. It's begging it's begging for us to click shift enter in Mathematica and get random configuration of flux field with three excitations, momentum P1, P2, P3. Click shift enter again, seven excitations, P1 up to P7. And then we click shift enter 50 million times and we sum all of them and we should get an awesome representation of our scattering amount. Sometimes when we click shift enter, we will get a configuration of 20 excitations, but almost never. The configuration that will dominate will be the lowest lying excited states, and the very, very excited states will be almost irrelevant. And this is something we want to do. We started already discussing this with Matt, and we are indeed going to put this in a computer and have a plot of a scattering amplitude at finite coupling. At the same time, while we analyze weak coupling, strong coupling, and limits, while we understand how to describe the scattering amplitude at finite coupling in a computer, we should perhaps also at the same time be even more ambitious. So as Jomé normally says, if you have a very powerful result, normally it can be put on a t-shirt. And the result here in the bottom, it's still too big to be put on a t-shirt. And if you add furthermore the explanation of what exactly it means to sum over psi and so on, then it definitely doesn't fit on a t-shirt. And perhaps you can do better. If you look, say, at the spectrum of your gauge theory, which was incorporated by this nice Y-system equation with some nice lattice related to the group theory of the problem at hand. This is something you could indeed summarize by a very cute picture and tell and describe the math of it in a very elegant way. The area that we have computed at strong coupling actually also took the form of a Lie system, a very different one. The lattice has nothing to do with this lattice. It has to do with the geometry, with the number of gluons, this n minus 5 here, that you scatter. Is there some master object? Is there some kind of Darth Vader that will really describe this object in a more powerful way and from which this expansion will come as you try to iterate to solve this quantum Y system or whatever it will be. Perhaps the merge, perhaps the fusion of these two, the quantum spectrum together with this Y system that describes the geometry. We don't know. But if it exists, it is possible that we will find it. It's likely that we will find it. Because now that we have this formulation of amplitude, there are many very important questions that we are trying to understand. And by really trying to understand these questions, we are really pushing our representation to its extreme. So if some hidden formulation of it exists, which is even better than what we have right now, I think when we will really push our formula to answer the toughest question, some questions are very trivial ones, for example, which shows a way of tessellating a polygon. It's like choosing a channel for expanding our OP. We could have chosen another channel. And it better be that all these channels give the same thing in the same way that in a CFT, if you OP expand in different channels, you get the same thing. And this was something that we could beautifully understand at strong coupling, how this Y system was compatible with all these channel developers. And it is something that is very hidden in this formulation. So by pushing and by obliging ourselves to understand how these different limits work, I think if something exists, we will find it. But again, we should always play this cautious and optimistic counterpart, like the devil and the angel on the top of our head. It might be that this is the very best there is. It might be, and why do I say that? Because it is often the case that when you have an integrable model, that the spectrum of the model is sublime. It's really beautiful, some Y system and something really, really very elegant. But then it is often the case in integrable models that if you ask, what about, say, correlation function, form factors in integrable models? Often the very best you have is a representation in terms of infinite sums. And that would be pretty much the analog of what we have here for computing this expectation value of this several pentagon. So we just don't know. Well, we have to investigate a bit further. I'm really concluding. So zooming further out, we were doing the spectrum, scattering amplitude. There are other things we are computing. Some of them are listed here. To really understand the gauge theory, what will be, I think, very, very exciting is really to have a solution of all these quantities, and more exciting to understand all the connections between them. How do these quantities talk to each other? What's the relation between Wilson loops, the spectrum problem, scattering amplitude, smooth Wilson loops, 3- and 4-point correlation functions, and so on. And more generally, it's a very exciting time, I think, to do quantum field theory. Let me maybe speak more now to the PSI students, in the sense that we are really living some years where there is a boom in our understanding of quantum field theory. Not only integrability and the kind of quantum field theory that I've been telling you about, but say localization, the conformal bootstrap, and many other things. And it's really exciting, and it's also very exciting that we start to see connections between all these different branches of quantum field theory. And I wouldn't be surprised if in a few years, these years will be seen as really the years of that were really a revolution in our understanding of quantum field theory. So I think there is no turning back. At this moment, I mean, I think to me at least, it is clear that we will understand this important question. We will see how a quantum field theory looks like. I mean, we will really have a quantum field theory like we have the 2D Ising model. We will have a quantum field theory, and we will really be able to see what it is and really understand this important question, how do gluons become strings, what's really the dynamical mechanism. We already start to see, as I try to convey, but I really think we will have a beautiful, very concrete picture. And so what? What next? Well, then we don't know. Then it's really like predicting next month's weather. I mean, that's really too much. What we believe is that it will be great. Well, not the weather, but the solution. Nothing can, yeah. Some other place there. So what else? Then we don't know. Well, if I'm writing some grand proposal, I write some fancy words about quantum gravity, holography, and whatnot. But let me spare you this painful moment. And let's try to just be a little bit conservative. What could be the most conservative scenario, say? I think that at the very least, I think it is reasonable to expect that our improvement in our understanding of quantum field theory will at least mimic, at least parallel, our improvement in our understanding of two-dimensional models that the Ising model solution by Anzager in 44 led. I think this is very reasonable to expect. And that was really like opening a Pandora box. There were whole fields of physics that didn't exist and that could exist only because of the solution of the two-dimensional Ising model. I mean, I was reading recently about Anzager's solution and the state of the art at the time, and it was not even understood whether when you will solve exactly some critical system, whether a phase transition will exist or will be smoothened out. So even things as basic as this, we don't understand. It were not understood, and now these fields are extremely mature, and we know a lot about phase transitions, critical phenomena, two-dimensional conformal field theories, integrable models, and so on. And I think by having a solution of a four-dimensional gauge theory at hand, I think it is very reasonable to expect that we might experience some very fruitful and unexpected results out of that. So thank you very much, and I will leave here some word cloud with some of the topics I touched upon and some of them that I did not, in case you want to be a little bit more inspired to ask more questions. Thank you.
So who wants to start off the questions?
Can you be a little more specific? So you said that if you have a solution to this specific gauge theory, that has, as you said, all these other theories hidden inside of it, mm-hmm. then so this will help us understand basically all the other gauge theories. But can you be more specific, like what qualitative features do you expect to hold or not hold when you sort of break these big factors in n equals 4 supreme models, like conformal symmetry, supersymmetry, or when you change the dimension? So other gauge theories that like condensed matter physicists or Heinrich theorists are interested in.
Okay, so this is a huge question that I could spend hours replying, so I don't know. Let me pick, for example, two possible answers. So one answer would be that, for example, we did learn a lot about how to deal with quantum spin chains, I think, and I think some of the lessons when dealing with quantum spin chains, you could say, can be transposable to other spin chain materials. For example, as I said, the Hubbard model is one example of a theory that is contained inside n equals 4 in a particular limit. And by analyzing n equals 4, Matthias Staudacker, Adam Ray, and Irina Servan, for example, by analyzing this particular subsector of n equals 4 where the Hubbard model shows up, they found that if beauty was to be there, there were very strong hints that the effective Hamiltonian of the Hubbard model at half filling, which means that the Hubbard model where you have as many electrons as sites, that there should be some extra term in the effective Hamiltonian in the expansion around half filling that people previously from working condensed matter had overlooked. And then indeed, people went back, they rechecked this computation, some factors of two were missing, and you fix the computation in the effective Hamiltonian of the Hubbard model, of the one-dimensional Hubbard model at half filling. And this was very much guided by our intuition in gauge theory. Let me give now a totally different and totally unrelated answer. For example, something that we have been playing with recently was understanding the collinear limit of scattering amplitudes at strong coupling. So typically when you have a scattering amplitude and consider a collinear limit, people think that they understand very well what happens, particularly based on perturbation theory. You take two gluons, you make them collinear, you just get a gluon with bigger momentum, up to some factors that are under very well control, very good control. But what we understood here is that we should be careful. And sometimes gauge theories can have a much richer collinear limit than you expect. And why was that? The reason was that if you look at the spectrum of our flux tube that I showed here, for example, where is it? If you look at the spectrum of our flux tube, the spectrum of scalar excitations in the top plot, the energy of the scalar excitations goes to zero. So it means that at strong coupling, our flux, chromodynamic flux tube is becoming gapless. And then when it is becoming gapless, you can no longer ignore the scalar excitations, and they give rise to a very interesting behavior of scattering amplitudes in the collinear limit. So this is an example that once you realize this, you can extrapolate and ask yourself, if I have other gauge theories which have some high symmetry group, that will have some dual, which we don't know very well, but which has some analog of some scalar sector, it is very likely that at strong coupling, the scalars will become very light because they correspond to Boltzmann modes in the sphere. And if that's the case, I expect those gauge theories to have a very rich collinear behavior, and we should be careful when just stating that perturbation theory gives you a good picture. So there are many lessons that you understand first in n equals 4, but that once you understand them, you realize that these have very little to do with integrability or with supersymmetry and so on. Especially because the quantities that we are studying, even though the underlying theory is supersymmetric, as soon as you put a flux tube and you are summing over millions of gluons and studying dynamics of flux tube, supersymmetry is long gone. I mean, you are really studying a very bosonic background, and supersymmetry is playing not such a big role in understanding the effective dynamics around this this background. I'm not sure if this answered your question. I could go on forever, but I think other people have to answer.
Is there what are the hopes for understanding the dynamics of this theory when the Higgs fields have VEVs? Because then you would have magnetic monopoles and all kinds of topological excitations, and is it conceivable that you might be able to calculate scattering amplitudes mm-hmm. between those?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think yes. I think. I think if you would give a VEV to your scalar field, then this is something that people actually have used and have thought about when trying to make these scattering amplitudes more well-defined. So I glossed over all the details of infrared divergences and UV divergences because we know how to take care of them. But these objects, when you scatter massless particles, like in QCD, are infrared divergent. And one way to regulate it is instead of scattering gluons of your theory, you separate your stack of brains that gives rise to n equals 4 and you scatter W bosons. So by scattering these massive particles, you can regularize your amplitudes, and there is a very beautiful structure. The reason is that this is a regulator which you control very well, even though you say that because I put some regulator, I break conformal symmetry. You know how it is secretly there. You just know that if you now make a rescaling, you should rescale your momenta, but also rescale the separation between the brains, which is your regulator. So if you allow yourself to play with very general regulators, you basically lose almost no symmetry when considering these objects. So and these people are starting to explore, and to explore this conformal symmetry and the fact that you can take these masses very small and very big. And there are some nice works in this direction. Maybe the reference I would say would be a very cute recent paper by Simon Caranuot and Johannes Hen, which is on trying to understand the analog, trying to understand that n equals 4 is a theory that has an analog. You know that the hydrogen atom has this extra conserved symmetry, this Runge vector that is, so that n equals 4 in a sense can be thought of as the quantum field theory that has the analog of this extra hidden symmetry. And when and they have a very cute paper that I think it's called something about like the hydrogen atom and so on, where they explore exactly this possibility of fixing and giving of f to the scalars and exploring its connection with scattering amplitudes. And I find that paper very cute. But I will, scattering amplitudes, sorry? No. I mean, here. Okay, that I don't know.
Okay, my question is a return to the first question, but I'm going to start by making a comment. When I was a young student, I heard the first talk that Polyakov gave in the United States, where he started by saying, I have a dream, and my dream is that QCD is really equivalent to a two-dimensional chiral model, which is exactly integrable, and we're going to solve it that way. And there was nothing about supersymmetry, n equals 4, large n, TUF coupling, or anything like that. There was just a dream about QCD.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, was he wrong, or is there a, do you see a path from the very beautiful results that you and your colleagues have to really understanding physical gauge theories, QCD?
So there are two things. One is that often, once we understand some mechanism in n equals 4 at finite coupling, we might wonder whether some lessons that we extracted there, whether they could have a parallel in other gauge theories, even though we solved it exactly and we could see how it works in n equals 4. Take, for example, this observation that I made before, that I said that this holographic direction was coming as some kind of composite of your, what you would call fundamental excitations of your flux tube. Can this be something universal, that you have flux tubes in some gauge theory with some excitations on your flux tube? And can it be that indeed you reproduce some holographic dual, but you should try to look for possible bound states of your fundamental excitations to give rise to this holographic direction? So this is something that would be probably hard to think about without this particular example where we see this dynamical mechanism. And if I wanted to be very, very, very speculative, but I am, because I just said that I would. For example, recently people are studying the chromodynamic flux tube of QCD. There are many interesting studies, but they are mostly phenomenological studies. That is, you can know a lot about flux tubes just based on the symmetries that they break. You just saw the Goldstone effective theory of flux tubes, and you find that's why basically Nambu-Goto is so good at describing the spectrum of mesons, because there is a huge universality. So people like Dukowski, Flogger, and so on have been developing these theories of the flux tube. And when you do, then you develop these effective theories, then you compute excited states, and you go and compare with lattice QCD. And it works well, reasonably well, but not as well as you might want. And then what you can ask is you can ask yourself, can now I modify phenomenologically my model, and instead of doing just this Goldstone excitation, add some extra particle by hand that will improve a lot my results to match better with lattice? This is the kind of exercise that they have been doing. And they find that indeed, they add a particular kind of particle, and then the data, they get a nice match with the data. And then recently I was chatting with Raphael and so on, and he was saying that then you put on this particle and study how it interacts with your Goldstone particle that you need to have there from the get-go. And you see that it is looking like it wants to be kind of thought of as kind of a composite object that's made out of something that they don't know what it is. So can it be that it is something a bit related to this, that you have some excitations of the QCD flux tube, maybe bosons that fermionize, or maybe fermions that form some kind of bound state, and this is the extra mode that they seem to want to add to find good matching with lattice? So this is something very, very wild. I think we are going to have a workshop here at PI where we are going to bring together real QCD, FlexSteel people, and us working in N equals 4. We have a very good toy model where we tame completely the FlexCube, but it is N equals 4. And they have this lattice QCD, this phenomenological understanding of the FlexCube, and they want to improve their analytic control. And hopefully, by discussing together, we'll be able to learn something. So this is one example where even though we are studying it in N equals 4, we are seeing some dynamical mechanisms that then we believe go well beyond it. And there are other examples. When people were studying these quantities in N equals 4, for example, correlation functions and Wilson loops, they understood some dualities between both that then were conjectured to be valid in any gauge theory, because it was once you understand why it works, you see that there was no reason for it to happen in N equals 4. But it would have been very hard to guess it without a theory where it would really test your idea. So this is one kind of answer. But the other kind of answer is that you could have asked the same question to Onsager when he was trying to solve the 2D Ising model. So imagine Onsager was trying to solve the 2D Ising model and people were on his back saying, what about if I put some extra fermions there and put more degrees of freedom and so on? He'll say, come on, let me solve first the Ising model. And indeed, this is what happened next. Then people put Pott's model, then did the model with fermions and so on. It was important to solve the simplest one first. And then it would have been very hard when he was solving the Ising model to say what would be the next order of limits and to guess that you would then discover minimal models and whatnot. So I think there is the more conservative answer, which is that many of the lessons that we learn are transposable to any other gauge theories, and then we go and check, and this has happened over and over. And there is the more wild answer, which is to say that it will be like the Ising model, and it will be some nice fireworks once we will have a solution of a gauge theory. For example, something that I should add about the Ising model. Right now, when people develop numerical methods, say to solve statistical models, what do they do? What does Giffre do? He goes to the Ising model to benchmark his meta codes and to benchmark his numerics. So it's very important to have exactly solvable solutions, even from this very mundane point of view, of whenever you then develop new techniques, to have something to check it in against. And for example, this flux cube, this picture of integrability and knowing the flux cube, it's already partially being used in this direction. People that did not know how to put string theory in a computer, string theory in ADS, are now trying to simulate it using Monte Carlo by putting the string theory in ADS. And what do they use to benchmark their Monte Carlo results and to know whether they are doing things right? This is Radu Roivan at Penn State. They use the result of integrability to see that the result of Monte Carlo lie within the integrability results. So it's already an example where this is being used exactly in the same way as the 2D Ising model is nowadays.
So most of my question that I was going to ask has already been asked by the first two, I think, questioners. Uh-huh. But let me add a little bit, and uh-huh. also one related technical question.
Okay.
So if I understand, there's many approximations or idealizations, we could say, in the theory that you've actually studied. Mm-hmm. It's supersymmetric. It has it has large N. It has conformal.
Those are the
main one. You dealt quite a bit with supersymmetry and conformal invariance.
The crucial one is the fourth one that you did not mention, which is that the dual description is integrable.
Well, and you think yes, but if we compare want to compare it to the real world, then mm-hmm. the at large N would be one that one could also question. So, maybe you can say a little bit about. Mm-hmm. Going from large N, from infinite N, to go into finite.
We would all do a huge celebration if we solve QCD at large N, right? This would be awesome. Yeah, I mean, even solving QCD at large N would be really tremendous, let alone finite N. But it's true that this is not QCD. So it's a couple of comments about large N. So first of all, the claim based on this intuition and based on what we have achieved so far is that each order in 1 over N you should be able to solve. That is, the leading order, it is just a surface without holes. The first 1 over n correction is the same surface with one hole. So it is just a different topology. So order by order, I think integrability will be able to tell you this is the solution to the problem. Now, a different question is whether I can resum all the powers in n and find some structure in their summation. But then again, okay, we didn't even compute one 1 over n correction. It's a bit too early to think about resummation. There, I think it's unlikely that integrability will be of much help. After all, if we could solve the full theory at any coupling at anything, we would solve turbulence in a way. I mean, we would have the full solution of n equals 4 and of the dual gravity and so on. So, no, we are not. I think that it's hard to imagine that we will be able to to solve everything, and then this one over n corrections that in practice they will be able will be easy to tame and so on. But I think at each order in 1/n we'll be able to solve.
Okay, so let me ask the technical question that might not be related, which is you have given a lot of evidence that this particular supersymmetric non-abelian gauge theory is integrable in some form. Now, do you know what is known about the classical integrability of that theory? I remember that there were some results, I think by Savidi and other people, about just finite and, you know, straight QCD-like theories that not only are they not integrable, but they're chaotic. So
those theories are secretly those theories are secretly two-dimensional. So it's true that there are some theories like self-dual Young-Mills and so on that people say are integrable, but often it is the case that it is just because in practice it's a very chiral theory that in practice it's two-dimensional. So let me just say something about the integrability. So integrability, what is integrability? Integrability is factorization. So how should we think physically about integrability? Integrability is the existence of some extra symmetry that acts in a very funny way. So if you have, if momentum is a symmetry of your physical theory, it means that you can do the experiment here or in Manhattan, you get the same thing. If energy is a symmetry of your system, you can do it today or tomorrow. If an extra charge, like Q3 written there, is a symmetry, it means something funny. It means that you have your experiment, and you can also shift it, but you shift different parts of the experiment by different amounts depending on the momentum of the excitation. So it means that if three excitations were to meet at a given point, you shift them by different amounts, and now they no longer meet at a given point. They meet one after the other, and this is integrable. So you can immediately say that in higher dimensions, this would be bad, because if you could move the wave packet by amount that they depend on their moment, so you could simply make them not scatter at all. And this is the essence of Kalman-Mandula theorem that tells you try to put too much symmetry, it backfires and you get a free theory. So this theory, it evades this no-go theorem of being integrable in this very clever way. It says, okay, you don't let me be integrable, I'll be cleverer than you. I will go to a two-dimensional description. In the two-dimensional description, I will be integrable, and then this is how the four-dimensional description is inherently integrable. So integrability in the four-dimensional sense, at the classical level, as you are saying, we do not expect for this reason. And when these theories are integrable in higher dimensions, it's because secretly they are two-dimensional. The dynamic is two-dimensional.
So in the naive sense, you expect it to be not integrable.
In the classical sense, not integrable, not at all. In the naive sense, you scatter three gluons, and you can get four gluons with totally different momentum. Nothing to do with that. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It's an untrivial system.
Your result that in the presence of a flux tube, bosons and fermions behave differently means that there is a very high susceptibility for supersymmetry breaking.
Oh, absolutely.
Does this imply that your vacuum may have spontaneous symmetry breaking of supersymmetry?
Absolutely. So the fact that the spectrum of excitations, this is exactly, I think, exactly what you are referring to. The fact that the spectrum of excitations, let me jump directly there. Fact that the spectrum of excitations that totally different masses is a good, is the simplest way to say that, of course, the supersymmetry is totally broken. I mean, the scalar, look at this picture. So what happens here? At weak coupling, you have unification. Usual unification. All particles have the same mass. And this, indeed, at weak coupling, when you turn off the flux tube, you recover supersymmetry. As you increase the coupling, you are putting these gluons being exchanged. You go to the bosonic vacuum, supersymmetry is broken, and the excitations have all different mass. However, there is one curve that looks special. The fermion looks less, always with mass 1. This is a consequence of Goldstone theorem, because this fermion can be thought as the Goldstone particle associated with the broken supersymmetry, exactly as you said.
OK, maybe let's thank Pecker again.
Thank you.